best infrared jammers available. One chance. You get only one chance. What if we are patient? What if we simply sit on the bomb for a year and bring it into the country for the next State of the Union speech? Getting the bomb close enough to the Capitol building to destroy it and everyone in it should not be hard. He'd heard, and would see tomorrow, that the Capitol was a building of classical construction. Lots of stone, but little structural ironwork. Perhaps all they needed was patience. But that wouldn't happen. Kati would not allow it. There was both the question of security and the more important consideration that Kati thought himself a dying man, and dying men were not known for their patience. And would it work in any case? How well did the Americans guard the areas where the president's presence was predictable well in advance? Were there radiological sensors in the area? You'd put them there, wouldn't you? Only one chance. You'll never be able to repeat this. At least 1 week's advance notice, or you'll never achieve anything beyond mass murder. Must be a place without the likely presence of radiological sensors. That eliminated Washington. Bach started walking away from the black iron fence. His face did not betray the anger he felt. Back to the hotel? Russell asked. Yes, why not? Both men were still tired from their traveling anyway. Good. Wanted to catch the ball game. You know, that's about the only thing Fowler and I see eye to eye on. Hmm? What's that? Football. Russell laughed. You know, football. Okay, I'll teach it to you. 15 minutes later, they were in their room. Russell switched the TV to the local NBC channel. That was some drive, Tom. The Vikings had to convert 6 third downs, and 2 of them required measurements. And 1 was a bad spot, President Fowler said. Ref didn't think so. Talbot chuckled. They're holding Tony Wills to barely 3 yards a carry, and 1 of those was his 20-yard break on the reverse that caught the Chargers napping. A lot of work for 3 points, Tim, but they did get the 3. And now the Chargers get their chance at offense. The Vikings' defense is a little iffy, with 2 of their starters out with minor injuries. I bet they're sorry to miss this one. The Chargers' quarterback took his first snap, faded back 5 steps, and hurled the ball toward his flanker, slanting across the middle, but a hand tipped the ball and it ended up in the surprised face of the Vikings' free safety, who pulled it in and fell at the 40. Bach found the game exciting in a distant sort of way, but almost totally incomprehensible. Russell tried to explain, but it didn't really help very much. Gunther consoled himself with a beer, stretching out on the bed while his mind rolled over what he'd seen. Bach knew what he wanted his plan to accomplish, but the exact details, especially here in America, were looking harder than expected. If only... What was that they said? The Secretary of Defense, Russell answered. A joke? Marvin turned. Sort of a joke. That's what they call the middle linebacker, Maxim Bradley, from the University of Alabama. But the real one owns the team. Dennis Bunker. There he is. The camera showed Bunker in one of the stadium skyboxes. How remarkable, Bach thought. What is this Super Bowl they talked about? That's the championship game. They have a playoff series of the most successful teams, and the last one is called the Super Bowl. Like the World Cup, you mean? Yeah, something like that. Except we do it every year. This year, well, actually next year, end of January, it's in the new stadium they built at Denver. The Sky Dome, I think they call it. They expect these 2 teams to go there. Russell shrugged. That's the talk. The regular season is 16 weeks, man, then 3 weeks of playoffs, then another week wait for the Super Bowl. Who goes to this last game? Lots of people. Okay, man, it's the game. Everybody wants to go to it. Getting tickets is a mother. These two teams are the best bet to go all the way, but it's real unpredictable, you know. President Fowler is a football enthusiast. That's what they say. He's supposed to go to a lot of Redskin games right here in D.C. What about security? Bach asked. It's tough. They put him in one of the special boxes. Figure they have it rigged with bulletproof glass or something. How very foolish, Bach thought. Of course, a stadium was easier to secure than it might seem to the casual observer. A heavy crew-served weapon could be fired only from an entrance ramp, and watching those was relatively easy. On the other hand, Bach closed his eyes. He was thinking in an unorganized way, vacillating between conventional and unconventional approaches to the problem. He was also allowing himself to focus on the wrong thing. Killing the American president was desirable, but not essential. What was essential was to kill the largest possible number of people in the most spectacular way imaginable, then to coordinate with other activities in order to foment... Think. Concentrate on the real mission. The television coverage for these games is most impressive, Bach observed after a minute. Yeah, they make a big deal of that. Satellite vans, all that stuff. Russell was concentrating on the game. The Vikings had scored something called a touchdown, and the score was now 10-0, but it seemed now that the other team was moving rapidly in the other direction. Has the game ever been seriously disrupted? Marvin turned. Huh? Oh, during the war with Iraq, they had really tight security. And you remember the movie, right? Movie? Bach asked. Black Sunday, I think it was. Some Middle East guys tried to blow up the place. Russell laughed. Already been done, man. In Hollywood, anyway. They used a blimp. Anyway, during the Super Bowl when we were fighting Iraq, they wouldn't let the TV blimp come near the place. Is there a game at Denver today? No, that's tomorrow night. Broncos and the Seahawks. Won't be much of a game. The Broncos are rebuilding this year. I see. Bach left the room and arranged for the concierge to get them tickets to Denver in the morning. Kathy got up to see him off. She even fixed breakfast. Her solicitude over the past few days had not made her husband feel any better. Quite the reverse. But he couldn't say anything about it, could he? Even the way she overdid it, straightening his tie and kissing him on the way out the door. The smile, the loving look, all for a husband who couldn't get it up, Jack thought on his way out to the car. The same sort of smothering attention you might give to some poor bastard in a wheelchair. Morning, Doc. Hello, John. Catch the Vikings-Chargers game yesterday? No, I, took my son to see the Orioles. They lost 6-1. Success was following Jack everywhere, but at least he'd kept his word to his son. That was something, wasn't it? 24-21 in overtime. God, that Wills kid is incredible. They held him to 96 yards, but when he had to deliver, he popped it for 20 yards and set up the field goal, Clark reported. You have money on the game? $5 at the office, but it was a 3-point spread. The education fund won that one. It gave Ryan something to chuckle about. Gambling was as illegal at CIA as it was in every other government office, but a serious attempt to enforce a ban on football betting might have started a revolution. The same was true at the FBI, Jack was sure, which enforced interstate gambling statutes, and the semi-official system was that half-point betting spreads were not allowed. All pushes, odds caused ties, forfeited into the agency's in-house charity, the Education Aid Fund. It was something that even the agency's own Inspector General winked at. In fact, he liked to lay money on games as much as the next guy. Looks like you at least got some sleep, Jack, Clark noted as they made their way toward Route 50. 8 hours, Jack said. He'd wanted another chance the previous night, but Kathy had said no.
You're too tired, Jack. That's all it is.
You're working too hard, and I want you to take it easy, okay? Like I'm a goddamn stud horse that's been overworked. Good for you, Clark said. Or maybe your wife insisted, huh? Ryan stared ahead at the road. Where's the box?
Here.
Ryan unlocked it and started looking at the weekend's dispatches. They caught an early direct flight from Washington National to Denver's Stapleton International. It was a clear day most of the way across the country. Bach got a window seat and looked at the country, his first time in America. As were most Europeans, he was surprised, almost awed by the sheer size and diversity. The wooded hills of Appalachia, the flat farmlands of Kansas, speckled with the immense circular signature of the traveling irrigation systems, the stunning way the plains ended and the Rockies began within easy sight of Denver. No doubt Marvin would say something when they arrived about how this had all been property of his people. What rubbish. They'd been nomadic barbarians, following the herds of bison, or whatever had once been there before civilization arrived. America might be his enemy, but it was a civilized country, and all the more dangerous for it. By the time the aircraft landed, he was squirming with his need for a smoke. 10 minutes after landing, they'd rented a car and were examining a map. Bach's head was dizzy from the lack of oxygen here. Nearly 1,500 meters of altitude, he realized. It was a wonder that people could play American football here. They'd landed behind the morning rush hour, and driving to the stadium was simple. Southwest of the city, the new Sky Dome was a distinctive structure located on an immense plot of ground to allow ample room for parking. He parked the car close to a ticket window and decided that the simple approach would be best. "Can I get 2 tickets for tonight's match?" he asked the attendant.
"Sure, we have a few hundred left. Where do you want them?"
"I don't know the stadium at all, I'm afraid."
"You must be new here," the lady observed with a friendly smile. "All we got's in the upper deck, section 66 and 68.
2, please. Is cash all right?"
"Sure is."
"Where are you from?"
"Denmark," Bach replied.
"Really? Well, welcome to Denver. Hope you enjoy the game." "Can I look around to see where my seat is?"
"Technically, no, but nobody really minds."
"Thank you."
Bach smiled back at the simpering fool.
"They had seats for tonight," Marvin Russell asked.
"I'll be damned."
"Come. We will see where they are."
Bach walked through the nearest open gate, just a few meters from the big ABC vans that carried the satellite equipment for the evening broadcast. He took the time to notice that the stadium was hardwired for the equipment. So the TV vans would always be in the same place, just by gate 5. Inside, he saw a team of technicians setting up their equipment, then he headed up the nearest ramp, deliberately heading in the wrong direction. The stadium had to seat 60,000 people, perhaps a little more. It had 3 primary levels, called lower, mezzanine, and upper, plus 2 complete ranks of enclosed boxes, some of which looked quite luxurious. Structurally, it was quite impressive. Massive reinforced concrete construction, all the upper decks were cantilevered. There were no pillars to block a spectator's view. A fine stadium. A superb target. Beyond the parking lot to the north were endless hectares of low-rise apartment buildings. To the east was a government office center. The stadium was not in the city center, but that couldn't be helped. Bach found and took his seat, orienting himself with the compass and the TV equipment. The latter was quite easy. An ABC banner was being hung below one of the press boxes.
"Hey!"
"Yes?"
Bach looked down at a security guard.
"You're not supposed to be here."
"Sorry."
He held up his tickets.
"I just bought them, and I wanted to see where my seats were so that I would know where to park.
I've never seen an American football game, he added, heavy on the accent. Americans, he'd heard, were always nice to people with European accents.
You want to park in Area A or B? Try to arrive early, like before 5. You want to beat the rush hour traffic. It can be a bear out there.
Gunther bobbed his head.
Thank you. I'll be leaving now.
No problem, sir. It's no big deal. I mean, it's the insurance, you know. You have people wandering around, they might get hurt and sue.
Bach and Russell left. They circled the bottom level just so that Gunther could be sure he had the configuration memorized. Then that became unnecessary when he found a stadium diagram printed on a small card.
Seen what you wanted? Marvin asked when they got back to the car.
Yes, possibly.
You know, that's pretty subtle, the American mused aloud.
What do you mean?
Dickin' with the TV. The really dumb thing about revolutionaries is that they overlook the psychological stuff. You don't have to kill a lot of people. Just pissing them off, scaring them. That's enough, isn't it?
Bach stopped at the parking lot exit and looked at his companion.
You have learned much, my friend.
This is pretty hot stuff, Ryan said, leafing through the pages.
I didn't know it was that bad, Mary Patricia Foley agreed. How are you feeling?
The senior field officer's eyes twinkled. Clyde has dropped, waiting for my water to break.
Jack looked up.
Clyde?
That's what I'm calling him.
Her. Whatever.
Doing your exercises?
Rocky Balboa should be in the shape I'm in. Ed's got the nursery all painted up. The crib is put back together.
Already, Jack?
How much time will you be taking off?
4 weeks. Maybe 6.
I may want you to go over some of this at home, Ryan said, lingering on page 2.
Long as you pay me.
Mary Pat laughed.
What do you think, MP?
I think Spinnaker is the best source we have. If he says it, it's probably true.
We haven't caught a whiff of this anywhere else.
That's why you recruit good penetration agents.
True, Ryan had to agree. The report from Agent Spinnaker wasn't quite earth-shaking, but it was like the first rumble that got people worrying about a major quake. Since the Russians had taken the cork out of the bottle, the Soviet Union had developed an instant case of political schizophrenia.
Wrong term, Ryan reflected. Multiple personality disorder, perhaps. There were 5 identifiable political areas. The true-believing communists, who thought that any divergence from the true path was a mistake. The forward-to-the-past crowd, some called them. The progressive socialists, who wanted to create socialism with a human face, something that had singularly failed in Massachusetts, Jack thought wryly. The middle-of-the-roaders, who wanted some free-market capitalism backed up with a solid safety net, or craved the worst of both worlds, as any economist could say. The reformists, who wanted a thin net and a lot of capitalism, but no one knew what capitalism was yet, except for a rapidly expanding criminal sector. And on the far right, those who wanted a right-wing authoritarian government, which was what had put communism in place over 70 years before. The groups on the extreme ends of the spectrum had perhaps 10% in the Congress of People's Deputies. The remaining 80% of the votes were fairly evenly split among the 3 vaguely centrist positions. Naturally enough, various issues scrambled allegiances. Environmentalism was particularly hot and divisive, and the biggest wild card was the incipient breakup of the republics that had always chafed under Russian rule, all the more so because of the political coda imposed from Moscow. Finally, each of the 5 groupings had its own political subsets. For example, there was currently a lot of talk from the political right of inviting the most likely Romanov heir presumptive back to Moscow. Not to take over, but merely to accept a semi-official apology for the murder of his ancestors. Or so the cover story went. Whoever had come up with that idea, Jack thought,
was either the most naive son of a bitch since Alice went down the rabbit hole, or a politician with a dangerously simplistic mindset. The good news, CIA's station Paris reported, was that the prince of all the Russias had a better feel for politics and his own safety than his sponsors did. The bad news was that the political and economic situation in the Soviet Union looked utterly hopeless. Spinnaker's report merely made it look more ominous. Andrei Ilyich Narmanov was desperate, running out of options, running out of allies, running out of ideas, running out of time, and running out of maneuvering room. He was, the report said, overly concerned with his waffling on the nationalities problem to the point that he was trying to strengthen his hold on the security apparatus, MVD, KGB, and the military, so that he could keep the empire together by force. But the military, Spinnaker said, was both unhappy with that mission and unhappy with the half-hearted way Narmanov planned to implement it. There had been speculation about the Soviet military and its supposed political ambitions since the time of Lenin. It wasn't new. Stalin had taken a scythe through his officer corps in the late 1930s. It was generally agreed that Marshal Tukhachevsky had not really posed a political threat, that it had been yet another case of Stalin's malignant paranoia. Khrushchev had done the same in the late 50s, but without the mass executions. That had been done because Khrushchev had wanted to save money on tanks and depend on nuclear arms instead. Narmanov had retired quite a few generals and colonels also. In this case, the move had been exclusively one of economizing on military expense across the board. But this time also, the military reductions had been accompanied by a political renaissance. For the first time, there was a true political opposition movement in the country, and the fact of the matter was that the Soviet army had all the guns. To counter that worrisome possibility, the KGB's third chief directorate had existed for generations. KGB officers who wore military uniforms and whose mission it was to keep an eye on everything. But the third chief directorate was a mere shadow of what it had been. The military had persuaded Narmanov to remove it as a precondition to its own goal of a truly professional force, loyal to the country and the new constitution. Historians invariably deemed the age in which they lived to be the one of transition. For once, they were right, Jack thought. If this were not an age of transition, then it was hard to imagine what the hell was. In the case of the Soviets, they were poised between two political and economic worlds, teetering, not quite balanced, not quite sure which way they would go. And that made their political situation dangerously vulnerable to... What? Jack asked himself. Damn near anything. Spinnaker said Narmanov was being pressured to make a deal with the military, which, he said, was part of the Forward to the Past mob, Group 1. The danger existed, he said, that the Soviet Union would revert to a quasi-military state that repressed its progressive elements. That Narmanov had lost his nerve. He says he's had one-on-one meetings with Andrei Ilyich, Mary Pat pointed out. Intel doesn't come any better than that. Also true, Jack replied. It is worrisome, isn't it? I'm not really concerned about a reversion to Marxist rule. What worries me... Yeah, I know. Civil war. Civil war in a country with 30,000 nuclear warheads. There's a cheery thought. Our position has been to cut Narmanov as much slack as he needs. But if our guy is right, that might be the wrong policy. What's Ed think? Same as me. We trust Khrushchev. I recruited him. Ed and I have seen every report he's ever sent in. He delivers. He's smart, well-placed, very perceptive. Ballsy son of a gun. When's the last time he gave us bad stuff? I don't know that he ever has, Jack replied. Neither do I, Jack. Ryan leaned back in his chair. Christ, I just love these easy calls. I don't know, MP. The time I met Narmanov. That is one tough, smart, agile son of a bitch. He's got real brass ones. Jack stopped. More than you can say for yourself, boy. We all have our limitations,
Even the brass ones go soft.
Mrs. Foley smiled.
Oops, wrong metaphor.
People run out of steam. Stress, hours, time in the saddle. Reality grinds us all down. Why do you think I'm taking time off? Being pregnant gives me a great excuse. Having a newborn isn't exactly a picnic, but I get a month or so off the fundamentals. Real life instead of the stuff we do here every day. That's one advantage we have over men, Doc. You guys can't break away like we women can. That may be Andrei Ilyich's problem. Who can he turn to for advice? Where can he go for help? He's been there a long time. He's dealing with a deteriorating situation, and he's running out of gas. That's what Spinnaker tells us, and it is consistent with the facts.
Except that we haven't heard anything like this from anyone else.
But he's our best guy for the inside stuff.
Which completes the circularity of the argument, Mary Pat.
Doc, you have the report, and you have my opinion, Mrs. Foley pointed out.
Yes, ma'am. Jack set the document on his desk.
What are you going to tell them?
Them was the top row of the executive branch. Fowler, Elliot, Talbot. I guess I go with your evaluation. I'm not entirely comfortable with it, but I don't have anything to counter your position with. Besides, the last time I went against you, turned out I was the one who blew the call.
You know, you're a pretty good boss.
And you're pretty good at letting me down easy.
We all have bad days, Mrs. Foley said, and she got awkwardly to her feet. Let me waddle back to my office.
Jack rose also and walked to open the door for her.
When do you do?
She smiled back at him.
October 31st.
Halloween.
But I'm always late. And they're always big ones.
You take care of yourself.
Jack watched her leave, then walked in to see the director.
You'd better look this over.
Narmanov?
I heard another Spinnaker came in.
You heard right, sir.
Who's doing the write-up?
I will, Jack said.
I want to do some cross-checking first, though.
I go down tomorrow. I'd like to have it then.
I'll have it done tonight.
Good. Thanks, Jack.
This is the place, Gunther told himself halfway into the first quarter. The stadium accommodated 62,720 paying fans. Bach figured another 1,000 or so people selling snacks and beverages. The game was not supposed to be an important one, but it was clear that Americans were as serious about their football as Europeans were. There was a surprising number of people with multicolored paint on their faces. The local team colors, of course. Several were actually stripped to the waist and had their chests painted up like football sweaters, complete with the huge numbers the Americans used. Various exhortatory banners hung from the rails at the front of the upper decks. There were women on the playing field selected for their dancing ability and other physical attributes, leading the fans in cheers. Bach learned about a curious kind of demonstration called the wave. He also learned about the sovereignty of American television. This large, raucous crowd meekly accepted stoppage of the game so that ABC could intersperse the play with commercials. That would have started a riot in the most civilized European soccer crowd. TV was even used to regulate play. The field was littered with referees in striped shirts, and even they were supervised by cameras and, Russell pointed out, another official whose job it was to look at videotape recordings of every play and rule on the rightness or wrongness of every official ruling on the field. And to supervise that, two enormous TV screens made the same replays visible to the crowd. If all that had been tried in Europe, there would have been dead officials and fans at every game. The combination of riotous enthusiasm and meek civilization here was remarkable to Bach. The game was less interesting, though he saw Russell genuinely enjoyed it. The ferocious violence of American football was broken by long periods of inactivity. The occasional flaring of tempers was muted by the fact that each player wore enough protective equipment as to require a pistol to inflict genuine harm. And so big they were. There could hardly be a man down there under 100 kilos. It would have been easy to call them oafish and awkward, but the running backs and others demonstrated speed and agility that one might never have guessed. For all that, the rules of the game were incomprehensible. Bach had never been one to enjoy sporting contests anyway. He'd played soccer as a boy, but that was far in his past. Gunther returned his attention to the stadium. It was a massive and impressive structure with its arching steel roof. The seats had rudimentary cushions. There was an adequate number of toilets and a massive collection of concession stands, most serving weak American beer. A total of 65,000 people here, counting police, concessionaires, TV technicians. Nearby apartments. He realized that he'd have to educate himself on the effects of nuclear weapons to come up with a proper estimate of expected casualties. Certainly 100,000. Probably more. Enough. He wondered how many of these people would be here. Most, perhaps, sitting in their comfortable chairs, drinking their cold, weak beer, devouring their hot dogs and peanuts. Bach had been involved in 2 aircraft incidents. One airliner blown out of the sky, another attempted hijacking that had not gone well at all. He'd fantasized at the time about the victims, sitting in comfortable chairs, eating their mediocre meals, watching their in-flight movie, not knowing that their lives were completely in the control of others whom they did not know. Not knowing. That was the beauty of it. How he could know, and they could not. To have such control over human life. It was like being God, Bach thought, his eyes surveying the crowd. A particularly cruel and unfeeling God, to be sure. But history was cruel and unfeeling, wasn't it? Yes. This was the place.
Chapter 19. Development. Commodore, I have real trouble believing that. Rick said as evenly as he could manage. He was tanned and refreshed from his trip to Hawaii. He'd stopped in at Pearl Harbor while there, of course, to look over the sub-base there and dream about having command of Submarine Squadron 1. That was a fast-attack squadron, but if a fast-attack guy like Mancuso could take over a boomer squadron, then surely turnabout was fair play. "Dr. Jones is a really good man," Bart Mancuso replied. I don't doubt it, but our own people have been over the tapes. It was normal operating procedure and had been so for more than 30 years. Tapes from missile sub-patrols were always examined by a team of experts on shore as a back-check to the sub's crew. They wanted to make sure that no one might have been trailing a missile boat. This Jones guy was one hell of a sonar operator, but now he's a contractor, and he has to justify his fees somehow, doesn't he? I'm not saying he's dishonest. It's his job to look for anomalies, and in this case what he did was to string a bunch of coincidences into a hypothesis. That's all there is here. The data is equivocal. Hell, the data is almost entirely speculative. But the bottom line is that for this to be true, you have to assume that the same crewmen who attacked a 688 were unable to detect a Russian boat at all. Is that plausible?
That's a good point, Harry. Jones doesn't say that it's certain. It gives it a 1 in 3 chance. Ricks shook his head. I'd say 1 in 1,000, and that's being generous. For what it's worth, Group agrees with you, and I had some people from Oppo 2 here 3 days ago who said the same thing.
So why are we having this conversation? Ricks wanted to ask, but couldn't.
The boat was checked for noise on the way out, right?
Mancuso nodded.
Yep, by a 688 right out of overhaul. All the bells and whistles.
And?
And she's still a black hole.
The attack boat lost her at a range of 3,000 yards at 5 knots.
So how are we riding it up? Ricks asked as casually as he could manage. This was going into his record, and that made it important.
It was Mancuso's turn to squirm. He hadn't decided. The bureaucrat part of him said that he'd done everything right. He'd listened to the contractor, booted the data up the chain of command to group, to force, and to the Pentagon experts. Their analysis had all been negative. Dr. Jones was being overly paranoid. The problem was that Mancuso had sailed with Jones for 3 very good years in USS Dallas and had never known him to make a bad call. Never. Not once. That Akula had been somewhere out there in the Gulf of Alaska. From the time the P-3 patrol aircraft had lost her to the moment she'd appeared outside her base, the Admiral Lunan had just fallen off the planet. Where had she been? Well, if you drew speed time circles, it was possible that she'd been in Maine's patrol area, possible that she'd left Maine at the proper time and made home port at the proper time. But it was also possible, and very damned likely, that she'd never been in the same area as the American missile sub. Maine hadn't detected her, and neither had Omaha. How likely was it that a Russian sub could have evaded detection by both top-of-the-line warships? Not very.
You know what worries me? Mancuso asked.
What's that?
We've been in the missile sub-business for over 30 years. We've never been tracked in deep water. When I was XO on Hammerhead, we ran exercises against Georgia and had our heads handed to us. I never tried tracking in Ohio when I had Dallas, and the one exercise I ran against Pulaski was the toughest thing I ever did. But I've tracked deltas, typhoons, everything the Russians put in the water. I've taken hull shots of Victors. We're so good at this business. The squadron commander frowned. Harry, we're used to being the best.
Ricks continued to speak reasonably.
Bart, we are the best. The only people close to us are the Brits, and I think we have them faded. Nobody else is in the same ballpark.
I got an idea.
What's that?
You're worried about Mr. Akula. Okay, I can understand that. It's a good boat, like a late 637 class even. For damn sure the best thing they've ever put in the water.
Okay. We have standing orders to evade everything that comes our way. But you gave Roselli a nice write-up for tracking this same Akula. You probably got a little heat from group for that.
Good guess, Harry. A couple of noses went decidedly out of joint, but if they don't like the way I run my squadron, they can always pick a new squadron boss.
What do we know about Admiral Lunan?
She's in the yard for overhaul now, due out late January.
Going by past performance, it'll come out a little quieter.
Probably. Word is that she'll have a new sonar suite, say about 10 years behind us, Mancuso added. And that doesn't allow for the operators. It's still not a match for us, not even close to one.
We can prove that.
How? Mancuso asked.
Why not recommend to group that any boat that comes across an Akula is supposed to track him aggressively? Let the fast attack guys really try to get in close. But if a boomer gets close enough to track without risk of counter-detection, let's go for that, too. I think we need better data on this bird. If he's a threat, let's upgrade what information we have on him.
Harry, that will really put group into the overhead. They're not going to like this idea at all.
But Mancuso already did, and Harry could see it.
Rick snorted.
So? We're the best, Bart. You know it. I know it. They know it. We set some reasonable guidelines.
Like what?
The farthest anyone has ever tracked in Ohio is what?
4,000 yards.
Mike Heimbach on Scranton against Frank Kameny on Tennessee. Kameny detected Heimbach first. Difference was about 1 minute on detection. Everything closer than that was a prearranged test.
Okay.
We multiply that by a factor of 5, say. That's more than safe, Bart. Mike Heimbach had a brand new boat, the first rendition of the new sonar integration system, and 3 extra sonar men out of Group 6, as I recall. Mancuso nodded.
Right, it was a deliberate test, and they worst-cased everything to see if anyone could detect in Ohio. Isothermal water, below the layer, everything.
And still Tennessee won, Ricks pointed out. Frank was under orders to make it easy, and he still detected first. And as I recall, he had a solution 3 minutes before Mike did.
True.
Mancuso thought for a moment.
Make it 25,000 yards separation. No closer than that.
Fine. I know I can track an Akula at that range. I have a very good sonar department. Hell, we all do. If I stumble across this guy, I hover out there and gather all the signature data I can. I draw a 25,000-yard circle around him and keep outside of it. There is no chance in hell that I'll get counter-detected.
5 years ago, Group would have shot both of us even for talking like this, Mancuso observed.
The world's changed.
Look, Bart, you can run a 688 in close, but what does it prove? If we're really worried about boomer vulnerability, why dick around? You're sure you can handle this?
Hell yes. I'll write up the proposal for your operations staff, and you can send it up the flagpole to Group.
This'll end up in Washington, you know that.
Yeah.
No more we hide with pride, huh?
What are we? A bunch of little old ladies? Damn it, Bart, I'm the commanding officer of a warship. Somebody wants to tell me I'm vulnerable, well, I'm going to prove that's a load of horseshit. Nobody has ever tracked me. Nobody ever will. And I'm prepared to prove that.
This interview had not gone the way Mancuso had expected at all. Ricks was talking like a real submarine driver. It was the kind of talk Mancuso liked to hear. You sure you're comfortable with this? It's really going to light a fire up the line. You're going to take some heat.
So are you.
I'm the squadron commander. I'm supposed to take heat.
I'll take my chances, Bart.
Okay, I'm going to have to drill the hell out of my people, especially the sonar troops, tracking party like that. I have the time, and I have a pretty good crew.
Okay.
You write up the proposal. I'll give it a favorable endorsement and send it up.
See how easy it is?
Ricks grinned. If you want to be number one in a squadron of good skippers, he thought, you have to stand out from the crowd. Op 02 in the Pentagon would get excited about this, but they'd see that it was Harry Ricks who'd made the suggestion, and they knew his reputation as a smart, careful operator. On that basis, plus Mancuso's endorsement, it would be approved after some hemming and hawing. Harry Ricks, the best submarine engineer in the Navy, and a man willing to back up his expertise with deeds. Not a bad image. Certainly an image that would be noted and remembered.
So how was Hawaii? Mancuso asked, surprised and very pleased with the commanding officer, Gold, of USS Maine.
This is very interesting. The Karl Marx Astrophysical Institute.
The KGB colonel handed the black and whites over to Golovko. The first deputy chairman looked over the photos and set them down.
Empty building?
Nearly so.
Inside we found this. It's a delivery manifest for 5 American machine tools. Very good ones, extremely expensive.
Used for?
Used for many things, like the fabrication of telescope mirrors, which fits very nicely with the Institute's cover. The same instruments, our friends at Sarova tell us, or used to shape components for nuclear weapons. Tell me about the Institute. Much of it appears to be entirely legitimate. Its head was to have been the DDR's leading cosmologist. It's been absorbed by the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. They're planning to build a large telescope complex in Chile and are designing an X-ray observation satellite with the European Space Agency. It is noteworthy that X-ray telescopes have a rather close relationship with nuclear weapons research. How does one tell the difference between scientific research and... You can't, the colonel admitted. I've done some checking. We have leaked information on this ourselves. What? How? There have been a number of articles published in various professional journals about stellar physics. One begins, imagine the center of a star with an X-ray flux of such and such, except for one small thing. The star the author described has a flux much higher than the center of any star, by 14 orders of magnitude. I don't understand. Golovko was having trouble with all this scientific gibberish. He described a physical environment in which the activity was 100,000 billion times the intensity inside any star. He was, in fact, describing the interior of a thermonuclear bomb at the moment of detonation. And how the hell did that get past sensors? Golovko demanded in amazement. General, how scientifically literate do you think our sensors are? As soon as that one saw, imagine the center of a star, he decided that it was not a matter of state security at all. That article was published 15 years ago. There are others. In the past week, I've discovered just how useless our secrecy measures are. You can imagine what it's like from the Americans. Fortunately, it requires a very clever chap to assimilate all the data. But it is by no means impossible. I've talked to a team of young engineers at Kushtum. With a little push from here, we can initiate an in-depth study of how extensive the open scientific literature is. That will take 5 to 6 months. It does not directly affect this particular project, but I think it would be a most useful study to undertake. I think it likely that we have systematically underestimated the danger of third-world nuclear weapons. But that's not true, Golovko objected. We know that... General, I helped write that study 3 years ago. I am telling you that I was grossly optimistic in my assessments. The first deputy chairman thought about that for a few seconds. Pyotr Ivanovich, you are an honest man. I am a frightened man, the colonel replied. Back to Germany. Yes. Of the people we suspect were part of the DDR bomb project, 3 are unaccounted for. All 3 and their families are gone. The rest have found other work. 2 could possibly be involved in nuclear research with weapons applications, but again, how does one tell? Where is the dividing line between peaceful physics and weapons-related activity? I do not know. The 3 missing ones. 1 is definitely in South America. The other 2 are merely missing. I am recommending that we launch a major operation to examine what's happening in Argentina. What about the Americans? Golovko mused. Nothing definite. I expect they are as much in the dark as we are. The colonel paused. It is difficult to see how they would have an interest in wider proliferation of nuclear weapons. It's contrary to their government policy. Explain Israel, then. The Israelis obtained nuclear material from the Americans over 20 years ago, plutonium from their Savannah River plant, and enriched uranium from a depot in Pennsylvania. In both cases, the transfers were apparently illegal. The Americans themselves launched an investigation. They believe that the Israeli Mossad pulled off one of the greatest operations in history, aided by Jewish American citizens in sensitive positions. There was no prosecution. What evidence they had came from sources that could not be revealed in court, and it was deemed politically inadvisable to reveal security leaks in so sensitive a government activity. Everything was handled quietly. The Americans and Europeans have been lax in selling nuclear technology to various countries. Capitalism at work. There is a huge amount of money involved. But we made the same mistake with China and Germany, did we not? No, the colonel concluded. I do not believe the Americans have any more interest in seeing German-made nuclear weapons than we do. Next step. I don't know, General. We've run all our leads down as well as we can without risk of detection. I think we need to look at activity in South America. Next, some careful inquiries within the German military establishment to see if there is any indication of a nuclear program there. If there were, we'd have known by now. Golovko frowned. Good Lord, did I really say that? What delivery systems are likely? Aircraft. There is no need for ballistic launchers. From eastern Germany to Moscow is not all that far. They know our air defense capabilities, don't they? We left enough of our equipment behind. Pyotr, just how much more good news will you leave me this afternoon? The colonel smiled very grimly indeed. No. And all those Western fools are rhapsodizing about how safe the world has become. The sintering process for the tungsten rhenium was simplicity itself. They used a radio frequency furnace much like a microwave oven. The metallic powder was poured into a mold and slid into the furnace for heating. After it became dazzlingly white hot, unfortunately not hot enough actually to melt the tungsten, which had a very high thermal tolerance, pressure was applied, and the combination of heat and pressure formed it into a mass that, while not quite metallically solid, was firm enough to treat as such. A total of 12 curved sections were made one after the other. They required machining to modest tolerances of shape and smoothness, and were set aside on their own section of shelving installed in the fabrication plant. The big milling machine was working on the final large beryllium component, a large metallic hyperboloid about 50 centimeters in length, with a maximum width of 20. The eccentric shape made for difficult machining, even with computer-assisted tools, but that could not be helped. As you see, the initial neutron flux will be a simple spherical expansion from the primary, but it will be trapped by the beryllium, Frohm explained to Kati. These metallic elements actually reflect neutrons. They are gyrating about at approximately 20% of the speed of light, and we will leave them with only this exit into the cone. Inside the hyperboloid will be this cylinder of tritium-enriched lithium deuteride. It happens so fast, the commander asked. The explosives will be destroying everything. It requires a new way of thinking. As fast as the actions of the explosives are, you must remember that we require only 3 shakes for the bomb to complete the detonation process. 3 what? Shakes. Frohm allowed himself another of his rare smiles. You know what a nanosecond is? That is 1/1,000,000th of a second, yeah? In that span of time, a beam of light goes only 30 centimeters. The time it takes a beam of light to go from here to here. He held his hands out about a foot apart. Kati nodded. Surely that was a very brief time indeed. Good. A shake is 10 nanoseconds. The time for light to go 3 meters. The term was invented by the Americans in the 1940s. They mean the time for a shake of a lamb's tail. A technical joke, you see. In other words, in 3 shakes, the time needed for a beam of light to go approximately 9 meters, the bomb has begun and ended the detonation process.
that is many thousands of times less than the time required for chemical explosives to do anything.
I see, Kati said, speaking both the truth and a lie. He left the room, allowing Fromm to return to his ghastly reveries. Gunther was waiting out in the open air.
Well?
I have the American side of the plan, Bach announced. He opened up a map and set it on the ground. We will place the bomb here.
What is this place?
Bach answered the question.
How many?
The commander asked next. Over 60,000 here. If the bomb's yield is as promised, the lethal radius will encompass all of this. Total dead will number between 1 and 200,000.
That is all? For a nuclear bomb, that is all?
Ismail, this is merely a large explosive device. Kati closed his eyes and swore under his breath, having only a minute before been told that it was something completely out of his experience. Now he was being told the reverse. The commander was bright enough to understand that both experts were correct.
Why this place?
Bach explained that too.
It would be very gratifying indeed to kill their president.
Gratifying, but not necessarily beneficial. We could take the bomb into Washington, but I evaluate the risks of detection as serious, far too serious. Commander, my plan must take into consideration the fact that we have only one device and only one chance. We must therefore minimize the risk of detection and base our target selection on convenience more than any other factor.
And the German end of the operation?
That is more easily accomplished.
Will it work?
Kati asked, staring off at the dusty hills of Lebanon.
It should. I give it a 60% chance.
At the very least, we will punish the Americans and the Russians, the commander told himself.
The question came next.
Is that enough?
Kati's face became hard as he considered the answer to that. But there was more than one question. Kati thought himself a dying man. The disease process had its ebbs and flows, like an inexorable tide, but a tide that never quite restored itself to where it had been a year or a month before. Though today he felt well, he knew that this was a relative thing. There was as much chance that his life would end in the next year as there was that Bach's plan would succeed. Could he allow himself to die and not do everything he could to see his mission accomplished? No. And if his own death was likely, what importance should he give to the lives of others? Were they not all unbelievers?
Gunther is an unbeliever, a true infidel. Marvin Russell is another, a pagan. The people you propose to kill, they are not unbelievers. They are people of the book, misguided followers of Jesus the prophet, but also people who believe in the one God.
Yet Jews were also people of the book. The Quran proclaimed it. They were the spiritual ancestors of Islam, as much the children of Abraham as the Arabs. So much in their religion was the same as his. His war against Israel was not about religion. It was about his people, cast out of their own land, displaced by another people who also claimed to be motivated by a religious imperative when it was really something else. Kati faced his own beliefs in all their contradictions. Israel was his enemy. The Americans were his enemy. The Russians were his enemy. That was his personal theology, and though he might claim to be a Muslim, what ruled his life had precious little to do with God, however much he might proclaim the opposite to his followers.
Proceed with your planning, Gunther.
Chapter 20. Competition. At the halfway point of the NFL season, the Vikings and Chargers were still the class of the league, Shrugging off their overtime loss to Minnesota, San Diego took their revenge the next week at home against doormat Indianapolis, whom they buried 45-3, while the Vikings had to struggle against the Giants in a Monday night game, emerging on the sweet side of a 21-17 score. Tony Wills passed 1,000 rushing yards in the third quarter of the season's eighth game, and was already consensus rookie of the year, plus becoming the official NFL